Welcome to Thinking Aloud, a podcast about the nexus of politics and all those things that make us human. From the Lindenwood University College of Arts and Humanities, I'm your host, Don Heidenreich. We previously discussed the nature of philosophy and the importance of ancient philosophers. Today, we will be discussing the philosophy and philosophers of the Renaissance, the Reformation, and the Enlightenment. To do this, I have as a guest today Dr. David Brown, professor of philosophy at Lindenwood University. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
How do Aristotle and Plato translate into the Reformation?
Well, the Reformation is sort of a transitory period. And for most philosophers in teaching in particular, the Renaissance period is sort of one of those periods that don't get a lot of discussion. You have separate courses on ancient, separate courses on medieval. Renaissance tends to be sort of dropped out. You have in part the decline of scholasticism in the Middle Ages, where Aristotle played a huge major role. And in the sciences, Aristotle is still ruling and dominant. But you had a recovery of sort of the literary tradition of the Greek and Roman period. And that pulls out a little bit more of the Platonic element, the Platonic myths and Platonic stories, as well as other kind of Greek stories and so on. And in the period, you find less sort of scientific Aristotelian kind of work being done and more sort of as a literary genre. In fact, at Lindenwood, we let the English department teach Renaissance literature and count it as a philosophy course because there didn't seem to be a separate group of or canon of distinct philosophers in that period. And the fact that it became more literary, associated with more literary, and the fact that Aristotle was taught by Plato, this sort of going back to the original sources, this idea that there's something about going back to central. And so Plato started coming back in a bigger way as the fame of Aristotle outside of the sciences was sort of declining. You find, for example, in the 1700s, David Hume commenting that Aristotle's fame is utterly decayed. And I think you see that kind of collapsing. Outside of the sciences, I think that's true. And Plato, the Platonic influence became dominant.
But you mentioned the idea of recovery. What do you mean by recovery of their sources?
Well, there's the ideas that we've heard a lot of people telling us how to think and what to think, and you've had the scholastic high point with St. Thomas Aquinas synthesizing Christianity and Aristotle, the great pagan literature. And the idea was, well, we've got the theology down because at least we're nominally, you know, in the Christian camp. Let's find out more about the sources from which Christianity draws and gets its stories, and that would lead you back to Aristotle and to Aristotle's mentor, Plato. And so it was sort of a recovery of that aspect of knowledge that they thought was lost or subsumed or even consumed in the Christian tradition, which at the time seemed to be fairly lethargic. There wasn't really a robust Aristotelian philosophy at the time. There wasn't a robust any other sort of philosophy at the time. It seemed to be sort of a nadir of philosophical thought. I mean, once that synthesis started to decay under Burdon and Ockham, you had the rise of nominalism and voluntarism. You had this sort of questioning that was going on, and in asking questions, you want to go back to the original sources. I don't want to just take your word for it. I want to see, where did you get this from? Where did it come from? Where did this idea originate from? And that seemed to be sort of part of the spirit of the Renaissance.
So when we get to the Reformation a little bit down the road, we're talking now about the advent of things such as the idea of humanism.
Right.
We see that with men such as Erasmus. Now, where's its basis?
I think the basis is more in the Greek literature and stuff they got it from. I mean, the idea from Aristotle wasn't humanist in the sense of promoting the human being as, you know, as an individual and human flourishing as an individual. Moral aspects, but they're always sort of subsumed under a social context. And to be honest, I'm not sure where it came, except insofar as voluntarism is increasing, that the idea that the will is the central part of the human being, then the idea of the human being as an autonomous, separate individual comes to the fore. Insofar as you see humans as a rational being, reason involves categories, reason involves essences and natures and so on. It's a communal kind of a thing. When you're focusing on the will and the individual, I think it lends itself in that way. And then you go back in the Greek and Roman literature and you find these great heroes, the individuals who stood up against, the individuals who fought, the individuals who wrestled with the gods. So I think you sort of get some of that. But I think it's in the collapse of that scholastic synthesis and the rise of the individual as an autonomous being focusing on their will as opposed to the intellect. Our intellects work the same. They have roughly the same kind of content. We think math the same way and so on. Our choices are utterly up to us. They're completely different and seem to be something other than what we think. We may agree about certain facts, but we may make different choices. And that leads to a rise of looking at the individualness of us instead of what sort of collective, the rational aspects.
So who are some of the great philosophers of this Reformation period that maybe don't get the attention that they should be getting?
Of the Reformation period?
Mm-hmm.
Some people haven't focused on Gabriel Biel as much, a great influence on Martin Luther, sort of carrying on that kind of Occamist tradition. Contemporary scholars of the period point out that the fame of Aquinas had declined dramatically by that period of time. People were reading him second and third hand, and they're reading largely through the lens of critics of Aquinas, namely Ockham and Burden and people like that, from largely from the Franciscan tradition, which emphasized the will as what's primary or essential to the human being. What is human beings are will. We have intellects, but it's the will that's the most important thing. And so they're trying to sort of flesh out that view. If the will is dominant, what does that mean? Of course, that goes all the way back to St. Augustine, particularly his work on free choice of the will. Augustine, as far as I've been able to find out or anyone's read, invented the idea of a will as an independent, separate power. Can't find an antecedent to that. It seems to be unique with him, and it was done specifically to account for sin. There had to be a way to get God off the hook for Adam and Eve sinning and to get us on the hook for sinning. It was an intellectual mistake that Adam and Eve made. Then God didn't make their minds correctly or didn't make them adequate to the world. How can you blame them and not God for making a mess of things? The will. He focused on something that hadn't been focused on. You know, weakness of will and so on, ocracy, it was talked about and discussed in Aristotle. You had elements of this in Plato and other people too, but the idea of it as being sort of a separate power. Within the Augustinian tradition, filtered through the Franciscans, it became more and more of a separate autonomous power that became identified with the essence of the nature of the human person. Gabriel Biel, I think, represents that very well. I can't think of any other particular philosophers of the period. You had some Renaissance philosophers, Cajetan on the Thomistic side. There were other people, but they honestly have not really left their mark for us. I mean, it is sort of a nadir period of philosophy where it's sort of sliding into what would become the Enlightenment.
Does Thomas More fit anywhere in here as far as philosophers go?
Well, he fits in, you know, in terms of politics and in terms of ethics, particularly the idea of conscience. You know, the famous Robert Bolt play and movie that he did, which, by the way, it's one of the few times that you have a film based on a literary source where the film is as good or better than the source. And Bolt managed to accomplish that. Here he had the idea of conscience. He could not support the divorce and remarriage in good conscience. So he maintained his silence, using the ancient principle, silence is consent, that they can't get me for what I don't say, those kind of things. And that worked for a while, and then it didn't. And then what do you do? And in the play, and I'm sure in real life it happened too, his daughter says, well, can't you swear with your mouth but leave your mind uncommitted, essentially? He's like, no, I can't do that. It's the whole person. I can't say words. He could play games with the word. If there's any comma out of place or anything out of place, he was lawyerly enough. He could have done that. But I think you see that. I think you also see his commitment to justice. He was a very just and moral person. When they tried condemning him for any kind of offense, offenses that everyone else seemed to be guilty of, they couldn't find anything against him. So they had to trump up some charges against him, but he preserved and maintained his conscience in a great way, like Socrates did before him. People have argued like Jesus before him. He stands in that tradition, but he's doing this as an individual. He was a member of the Catholic Church, but there's rampant corruption in the church. So it wasn't the bishops that he relied on or a pope that he relied on. He had to rely on his own conscience and his own judgment, which is a very kind of Protestant way of looking at things, a very Lutheran kind of way of looking at things.
Kind of an irony on that one, isn't it?
It's a bit of an irony, yes.
So would you then possibly make the argument that he would be an early public philosopher, somebody who is not normally seen as a philosopher, but who did do things that might impact the way we perceive things?
Yeah, I mean, his book Utopia, you know, talked about some of these kinds of things, and his speeches and letters and so on. The public engagement of a person of faith, but also a person of the world, who knew how to navigate the world and still try to preserve their integrity as much as possible and so on. Failing because you can't be perfect, but sort of how does a person live in the world, maintaining their own personal faith and conscience, and yet still avoid persecution, harassment, and so on. And I think he does that. He's the patron for politicians. He's a patron saint for lawyers. So he's recognized as one of those people that today you could look to as a role model and a guide for what do you do if you're confronted with a moral choice? Well, you can sort of play around the edges, but if it comes down to it, You cannot compromise your beliefs for the sake of anything. You hold your soul in your hand when you take your oath from the film. And so you can't swear falsely with your mouth and leave your head unconfirmed. No, because your soul is in your hands. As if you were swearing to God, this is true. And you don't want to lie in that case.
Well, that would be quite understandable. One other person from this era that I would be interested in hearing what you have to say about, and that's Erasmus, who is both seen as a philosopher and as a theologian. And where does he fit in this whole thing, particularly because he's a contemporary with Luther, and I think it's interesting to see them compared.
He was one of those people about whom it could be said, you know, he knew almost everything that was capable of knowing. Clearly an intelligent, well-read person. He also allowed people to recognize, for example, Socrates, jokingly, you could call him Saint Socrates, as sort of a fellow Christian, fellow believer. So for him, the separation between the secular and the sacred, which the Renaissance focusing more on the secular, going back to Greek and Roman sources and so on, there seemed to be no conflict for him. So in a sense, he was embodying a kind of synthesis that you saw on a more intellectual, rationalistic basis in Aquinas later on. So you found him sort of defending this kind of old approach to things, this synthetic approach, where it's not an or, this or that, but it's this both and. What can we do to combine these things together? So it's not confrontational, it's synthetic, which, by the way, that comes also in Aquinas's work and in Aristotle's work. They were all very synthetic. There's some truth in these different positions. Let's combine them together, see where we could find points of agreement where the truth really seems to be manifest if no one's disputing it, and correct the errors where those individuals went wrong. And so he's kind of on the forefront of that. But as a humanist, because he's recognizing the independent value of a human being, apart from overt religious context, apart from an overt theological context, that there's a human dignity, again, Saint Socrates, not a Christian before Christ, but yet someone you sort of, by calling him Saint Socrates, you bring into the fold. And he was more than willing to do that. You could call it syncretism, or you could call it something like that. And that would not be something that would go down well with Dr. Luther.
No, I can imagine not. Let's move on to the topic of the Enlightenment. When we say Enlightenment, what do we mean?
Well, Enlightenment, you get the idea on purpose that the light bulb goes on, that suddenly light has come into a dark room. There's a transformation when things are illuminated that weren't illuminated before. The idea of illumination and lights and so on, that's, I believe it's universal, if not universal, it's almost universal, that kind of idea. And so here, this represents the after the dark ages and all this bad stuff. You know, now suddenly we've got it.
Where do we start? Where does the Enlightenment come from?
Well, as a historian, which I'm not, and so I don't want to tread on your turf, you could see the collapse of the medieval synthesis, the rise of sort of more pagan ways of thinking, Greek and Roman kinds of ways of thinking, and the decline of that synthesis leading to sort of, I don't want to say chaos, but lack of questioning, lack of abilities. There's nothing firm here. Luther in the Reformation played a big part in that because it shattered Christendom. This uniform culture that shared, at least nominally shared, certain traditions and practices and beliefs, lines of authority and so on, focusing on the individual and other things, that raised into question the received body of wisdom. After that, there are more and more problems, to pick on Luther a little bit. His idea that the gospel was so easy to understand that even the milkmaid could understand it became problematic when people were reading the Bible contrary to the way Luther read the Bible. That was something that technically probably shouldn't have occurred. And when it did occur, it created problems. So then who do we turn to? You had the rise of other kinds of Luthers, anti-Luthers. You had further fragmentations. And so the question of authority on the religious side became a dominant question. Political authority came into question. You had, again, with the Reformation, you had political realignments that hadn't happened before. You had the rise of more autonomous kingdoms or states or areas. On the scientific side, you had a problem that science had seemed to be stultified. Now, throughout the Middle Ages, you can find all kinds of technological innovations and advancements and so on. These were not ignorant kind of people. You could even find some theoretical kinds of advancements. But there were certain things that just didn't really flourish under that. One of the questions was, you know, how does the wind feel cold to you and cold to me? Well, the scholastic idea, the traditional Aristotelian idea is, well, the wind feels cold because it possesses coldness. And the wind would feel hot because it possesses hotness. But if we're in the same wind and you say hot and I say cold, the same wind can't be both hot and cold. It can't give you hotness and give me coldness and so on. So there's certain kinds of scientific questions. Well, you find people like Copernicus in a lesser kind of way, but particularly Bacon, Galileo, and Descartes seem to be sort of the foundation. Bacon in particular said, look, we need a new way of thinking. We need a new tool, a new organon. Past thinking has tended to conform reality to our ideas, and it's led us astray. One of the examples is that some of the scientists were completely convinced that there could be no more than seven planets in the solar system. There were no more than seven planets. On the basis of what? On the basis that God created seven openings in the human skull. And if there's seven openings in the human skull, there couldn't be more than seven planets in the solar system. That's reading your theory into nature, making nature conform. So I don't need to look for an eighth planet. I don't need to look for anything. There's seven because God made seven holes in my head. So there you go. That didn't work. So Bacon was saying, we need a new way of looking at things. Galileo, looking at reality and addressing the question of the wind feeling cold and hot, separated out temperature from coldness and hotness. And Galileo said, look, the way you solve the problem is really simple. You feel cold because cold is in you. The wind stimulates that in you. And I feel hot in the same wind because cold stimulates that in me. Hot and cold are in you and me, not in the wind. So it doesn't have contradictory properties. What's in the wind is temperature, mean molecular motion. So the temperature is, say, 70 degrees. Well, if you feel it's hot and I feel it's cold, those are subjective. Those aren't real. They're not about reality. It's just saying in a 70-degree wind, under certain physiological conditions, you feel cold and I feel hot, or vice versa. And so he began to treat questions like this. Bacon comes along and says, look, we need to forget everything we've learned, the idols of the tribe, the idols of the marker of place, all these things, and be quiet and let nature teach us. We need to probe her with questions and let nature teach us so that then we can control her and make her subject to human will. Again, human will. That knowledge is power. That's Bacon. The old idea was knowledge is understanding. Knowledge is a grasp of the whole. That's progressing toward wisdom. Bacon gave us the idea knowledge is power. It's about manipulating. And if you want to manipulate, you need to understand that some things are subjective, some things are objective. Descartes comes along and in part inventing analytic geometry and so on. Descartes really tried to mathematize the sciences. So if you're taking sciences today and you've got to study mathematics, thank Mr. Descartes. He's the person largely who's responsible for this. And his reasoning was really simple. Where do we find certainty in the world? You can't find it in politics. Governments change back and forth. People say things back and forth. You can't find it in religion because who do you believe? And he's thinking just of Christianity. Do you believe the Pope? Do you believe Luther? Do you believe Calvin? Do you believe the Anabaptists? Do you believe these people, these people, these people, these people? There's no sort of reliable source. You go back and you read literature, you can't find it. And Descartes says, I've studied all these things, right? I can't find it. The one place he could find certainty was in mathematics. And so Descartes came up with this idea, his revelation that he got from God when he had that dream. God shook him and, you know, that mathematics, if it could be applied to things outside of numbers and quantities, mathematics could give a certainty because the method of mathematics gives certainty. It gives a way of testing and proving things. If it could be applied, we have to do that. But in order to do that, we've got to apply to things we can count and number. Well, Galileo had also said that reality is what could be given measure, weight, and number. That came from the Scholastics, the Book of Wisdom. I don't remember which chapter, but the Book of Wisdom said God created everything he made according to measure, weight, and number. Well, Galileo and other people took that to say all reality is what can be given measure, weight, and number. And if that's what reality is, and Descartes' like, well, the mathematic method gives a certainty, well, then if I can mathematize the world or my experience of the world, then I can have certainty in math. So there's this hope, this enlightenment. We don't need faith anymore. Reason can tell us nature's inner workings, nature's secrets. It can penetrate to the mind of God. And insofar as nature's a reflection of the mind of God, the choice of God, the will of God, and I know nature, then I know the way God thinks. I have insight into that. And I can apply the method across the board. So this is now the light bulb. It's reason, not faith. It's reason that can do all this.
So this ties, in a sense, to Galileo's famous quote about the Bible tells you how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go.
Right. Right. We're separating out those two things. Now, Galileo got in trouble because he was lecturing the church on theology based on his science. And we also have to realize, and this is universally recognized, that his science wasn't as certain as what he said. He really didn't have the scientific evidence for his conclusions that he seemed to think he had. So on the basis of that, even the scientists sort of questioned what he said. But then when he pronounced theological and metaphysical statements, he contradicted that very claim.
When we're talking about the Enlightenment, we're really talking about more than one event generally.
Yeah, but we, at least on the philosophical side, we identify with the rise of modern science, the rise of mathematical ways of thinking from the Cartesian side, or empirical ways of thinking from Francis Bacon's side, essentially recapitulating the arguments between Plato and Aristotle. But this is in sort of modern form. And modern science has inherited both of those things, which has led to certain kinds of philosophical problems and questions. You have an empirical method, that's the Bacon side, but you want to mathematize it to get some degree of certainty, that's the Cartesian side. And those two things are in tension as much as the philosophy of Plato and Aristotle are in tension. There's some commonalities. So yes, there is, and it happens over a period of time. But there's no sort of unified political authority, cultural authority. There's no unified religious authority. In fact, there are religious wars going on, political wars going on. So there seemed to be no sort of stability here. They weren't content to rest in the myths and stories of the Greeks and the Romans. The Renaissance seemed to be particularly fond of those kinds of things. They wanted something better than, more than just arguments from authority, religious authority, or even secular authority. They wanted things that could be proven and demonstrated and known for certain so that there'd be no mistake or error about them.
Does this also touch a great deal on economics and politics?
Yeah, I think it does. Now, I'm not an expert in those kinds of areas, but it touches enormously on these kinds of things. If reality is as was described, then it changes the way we look at everything. Thomas Hobbes was probably the first person who really systematically tried working through the moral and political implications of this. And given the sort of Calvinistic background that he had, he took a very negative view toward human nature.
It's also worth noting, though, that his writing is taking place during the English Civil War, which was not a particularly uplifting period.
Right. And so, again, he's trying to make sense of and find his way through this. But you had this idea of measure, weight, and number, of analyzing, reducing things down to the component parts. And so he wanted to come up with an account of human society, human morality. And he wasn't skeptical like Nietzsche was. He didn't come out like John Locke came out and said, look, if property was given by God to Adam, if authority was given by God to Adam, and therefore to Adam's successors, if that's true, and so authority and power and property and stuff go back to God's grant to Adam, if that's true, we don't know who the rightful heirs are. So anyways, even if it's theologically true, it's practically useless. So let's start with another story. And so Hobbes starts with what he called the state of nature. What are human beings like apart from any sort of social conditioning where we're selfish, evil, rotten, bad people, right? Life is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. You don't get ethics out of that. Now, there is a legitimate question whether Hobbes really believed this or used this as sort of a worst case scenario, but he pretty much seems to stand by this because it's in keeping with the new modern scientific view of the world. And he said, look, the ancients thought we were social animals. They're totally wrong. We're isolated, individual, autonomous human beings, like atoms. And atoms just bounce off one another and stuck together, sometimes didn't stick together. That was sort of the early view of physics. Human beings are the same way. We're in constant conflict. So how do you get morality or the state out of this? Well, it's very simple. If life sucks and it's so bad in the state of war, we want it to stop. Well, the only way to make it stop is to make peace with people. Well, the only way to make peace with people is to not kill them, right? Not hurt them. And so we're driven to make a deal with other people, the social contract. We're driven to make a deal with people out of our fear and our greed. So this is different than the organic view of civilization and humanity that existed prior to this. This is really depends upon the physics, the metaphysics of the Enlightenment, of seeing people as autonomous, isolated individuals. We come together, we make this deal, but we realize we're not going to keep the deal. As soon as you turn your back, I'm going to stab you in it. So we have to have an authority to keep us in line, the Leviathan, the state. And even the state isn't better than us. The state has the power of life and death, but if the state goes too far, when life becomes like the state of war, then we rebel and we overthrow the state. So while you have a king who could actually do anything they want, they could take anything they want, do anything they want, they're unstoppable. If the king goes too far, there's always some barons that could take him out, or just peasants that could uprise and take the king out. So even then, they live in fear of their actions, and so they're not above this. Well, from the organization of the state as purely a power structure, morality simply is what's rewarded or what's punished. The state generates morality. Now, Locke, of course, objects to that and thinks, no, in the state of nature, there is a morality, there is a natural law, and the state comes into existence to protect and defend those natural rights. And if it doesn't, then there's a moral obligation or moral reason to oppose the state and overthrow the state. For Hobbes, morality doesn't exist until the state exists. And the state exists just as a mechanism of fear. By the way, that also applied to the family. The opposite view, going from the beginning, Cicero again said, the family is the seedbed of the state. We're most attracted to our family, immediate family, family, then our extended family, our friends, the people in our community, so on and so forth. These are the natural ways in which we build society and build civilization. This just seemed to be taken for granted. This is just the way it was. If we're isolated, autonomous human beings, like isolated autonomous atoms, you know, bouncing around, that story doesn't work. So here you have authoritarian kinds of government. You have no moral criteria by which to judge the state, because the state is the creator of rights and the creator of value, not the church, not God, not nature. This is a wholesale rejection of the tradition of the past. And you have that Baconian element of the will. C.S. Lewis had this really nice little phrase. And of course, there's some exaggeration, but nice little phrase that the ancient person studied the world to conform themselves to the pattern of the world. The modern study the world to conform it to our desires.
An interesting inversion of ideas.
Yes, and you sort of see that in Hobbes. Now, a lot of people did not like his justification. If you look in the history, particularly in British and Scottish philosophy, Mandeville seems to be about his only great defender. Everyone else is trying to come up with an account justifying morality and justifying political structures and political institutions on grounds other than what Hobbes did. But Hobbes clearly laid this out. Here's the landmark. And then later on, you'll find Machiavelli, you know, arguing it's better to be feared than loved. Directly opposite of what Cicero said. He hated Cicero, by the way. Directly opposite of Cicero saying it's better to be loved than feared. Machiavelli just flips it around. Because if human beings are just cogs in a machine, we could be put in a machine and we could grind out whatever the machine has for us. In a sense, a big version of 1984, read the novel, which we just recently did in a class. It's just about power.
So where does Locke fit into all this?
Locke, by the way, and the reason I mentioned Cicero is Locke was a great fan of Cicero and classical learning. In fact, when he died, he was writing a commentary on Cicero's De Officiis. And in numerous letters, he said, outside the Bible, the only thing you need to read for secular ethics is Cicero, you know, representing the classic kind of tradition. Locke fundamentally wasn't as skeptical about human nature as Hobbes. He didn't have that same kind of, we're wholly, totally corrupt in every single way possible. No, he said, in the state of nature, we have a state of rights. It's a state of liberty, but not a state of license. He didn't focus on the elements of love, but you could sort of see that in the family, people love and care for one another. Yeah, you might hit your brother or sister or something like that. But you can work that out in the family. So there's just still sort of love where you come together, you defend one another. And then that naturally does get extended to extended family and friends and so on and so forth. And that's from which you get the kind of social structures. Well, morality for him can't come after, because then there's no moral impulse going there, that there's a morality pre-political, that we know that you don't hurt your brother or sister. You just don't go around hurting your family for no good reason. We know that. For Hobbes, in the state of nature, it's a war of all against all and anything goes. That's the first rule, right? Is that there's anything to protect and preserve yourself. Well, no, that's not the way families work. They work to protect and preserve each other as a group. Parents sacrifice for themselves for their kids in numerous kinds of ways. There's this mutual love and respect and self-sacrifice and so on that exists prior to the existence of the state. And so the state is sort of a bigger version of that kind of organic unity. So he couldn't see rights in particular or ethics as the generation of the state, the effect of the state. No, it's what causes the state. The reason we come together to form a state is it's more effective. If we have to protect ourselves against robbers, it's more effective if we work together and we take turns. You watch your property and mine tonight and I'll do it tomorrow night. Or better yet, if we can find somebody else to watch these things for us. If we can create an independent judiciary, because if you and I have a disagreement, of course, we're going to fight it out because you're going to want what you want. I'm going to want what I want. We need some third party, a disinterested party, and so on. So he had a much more benign view of human nature, not naive, but a much more benign view, which was largely adopted in the United States Constitution, affected our founding fathers and so on in enormous kinds of ways. Arguably, sort of an anti-Hobbesian, more Lockean kind of approach to constructing a government.
It's also worth noting that where Hobbes is writing during the English Civil War, Locke is writing during another revolution, but it's the Glorious Revolution, a lot less bloodshed, a lot quicker, and the results were much more, in the minds of probably the majority of the English population, much more positive.
Yeah, which would lend yourself to thinking maybe we aren't as bad as all that. Hobbes could look around and see and look at the history before, like we are really, as a people, right? We're really, really bad people. We're always fighting and killing and arguing over silly things, trivial things, important things, whatever. And that just doesn't seem to stop. And it doesn't seem like it ever will stop. So yeah, he's writing from a much more optimistic period. But I think also his background in the ancients led him to be a more favorable conclusion that there is sort of a natural affinity and natural sympathy in human beings, where Hobbes wanted to reject that, that humans are social animals or political animals. He rejects, Hobbes rejects completely and entirely, and Locke seems to accept that.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. We're going to have to come back and talk about the French philosophes and forward in another show, and I'm looking forward to that. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll be back soon.